This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
$3.5 billion increase in K-12 funding over just the next 10 years. Permanent certainty for our schools and educators with additional ongoing sustainable funding into the future. Real reforms that protect the general fund through tough economic times. Protections to ensure that the state land trust fund continues to grow and support future generations. And to top it off, it ends the lawsuit.
That was the governor of Arizona signing a statement culminating a big, big education deal. We have with us today Holiday Moore instead of Mike Russell.
We have two, I think, of the best people to talk about this $3.5 billion deal. Chuck Essex is with Government Relations Arizona Association of School Business Officials, and then Andrew Morrill with Arizona Education Association. And both of you are former teachers, so you both have experience beyond the administrative side.
We both have experience in the trenches of working in school districts around the state, right?
Well, Chuck, you're the budget guru, I understand. And here's what I want. As a layman, I went through these numbers, and we've got tight time to do this. So what I'd like to do is I want to run through quickly my understanding of what the deal is and have you correct me if I'm wrong. And I want to focus mostly on one-year deals, because any number, how much of a budget impact there is in the first year, because any number gets really large if you start compounding interest over a lot of years. But the basic history of this was the following, that the voters passed some years ago an initiative that requires the legislature to fund K-12 education at a certain level, with including inflation. There was an economic downturn, 07, 08. The legislature said, we don't have the money and we're not going to do it. The schools sued, and at every juncture so far, the schools had won. But there's a problem with getting enforcement, and the thing is still in litigation. The court said the following. One, the state owes $1.5 billion roughly in arrears funding for stuff you were supposed to fund but did not. You should pay $331 million more a year immediately and increase the base funding to $240 per student. Is that essentially correct?
Pretty much, except what happened that brought the lawsuit about, and it was in 2000 that the voters approved Proposition 301, which had the inflation adjustment in it. But what the legislature said, we were really hurting for money, and they had their attorneys look at if they just increased a small portion of the formula for inflation, that would meet the voter mandate. And that's what
and the courts did not agree.
The court said that was not correct.
So now we have a deal. And the governor brought everybody together. And again, I want to discuss first year only. Again, this is what I think. Tell me what the deal is, essentially.
Well, the deal basically is that for the first 10 years, there will be some revenue coming from the state land trust to be about 59% of the total monies.
And there already was money coming from the state land trust, but they agreed to up the percentage, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
And then there'll be about 41 over the 10-year period of time, a little over 40% of the monies will come from the state general fund.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what they will do is not move the inflation factor all the way up to where the court said it had to go, but they'll move it up 70% of what the court ordered.
Okay.
And then
I've seen that. You're getting 70% of what was mandated. That's where that figure comes from.
They said increase the base funding factor in the formula by $240, and this increases the base factor by $173. And
tell me what that base funding factor, the average person doesn't know what that means.
Students we have a weighted funding formula, as probably the majority of states in the country have, that high school students are funded at a little higher level than elementary, special ed students are funded because of their special education needs or whatever. And the formula starts out with a number that gets put into it's kind of like your hourly rate of pay. And that rate of pay or the base level gets put into the formula. And if that number grows, the whole formula grows by inflation.
Okay, so I went through the numbers. Here's what I get. It says the deal is you get $300 million extra dollars this year. And correct. Let me translate this. There's about 1.1 million students in the schools, right? So that means a little less than $300 a person.
About $270 on average. Some districts will be a little more, some a little
just
less.
Just to get it down to a level where people, your kid gets $270 more than they were getting before.
And is that on the average, what we would see in a state next door to us, or not necessarily California, but in New Mexico and Utah? And
Each state's increase would be different. Like California, just in the last few years, has had a major reform of their education funding system and put a significant amount of additional dollars into their formula. So some states will be more, some states will be less. Doesn't move us up. We're 48th right now when you look at revenue per pupil in the state, or you look at spending per pupil in the state. We're 48th. We're ahead of Idaho and Utah. Right above us is Oklahoma. And this settlement, and it's good. It provides more resources. People shouldn't say, well, it doesn't mean anything because it doesn't move us up. It gets us closer to Oklahoma, but they'll still be ahead of us because it wasn't designed to fix all the problems with education funding. It was designed to settle the lawsuit, a very specific thing. And it's important, but it doesn't may mean Arizona no longer has challenges in the way it funds its public schools.
And really, it's just meeting what the baseline requirements were to keep up with the cost of inflation.
It meets the requirement that the voters put in 1980 when they voted. They said, we don't want schools to lose ground to inflation, because then you can't keep pace with your needs, because if it costs you more to do things, you'll have to do less of those things if you don't get an inflation adjustment.
Though it's my understanding, this deal doesn't go into – this requires a vote of the people, right, in May. And that is because, if I understand it, because of the deal that most of this money comes out of the state land trust.
59% of it comes out of the state land trust. But the election will be in May 17th of 2016. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It's going to be called Proposition 123, which is kind of interesting for education. But there's a couple of reasons why it's required. First, to increase the amount of money that gets distributed from the state land trust is in the Constitution, and only voters can increase that distribution amount. Mm-hmm. And there's some provisions in the inflation funding that gives the state a little bit of relief if we have a bad economic term, downturn or whatever. So that's the main reason for the election requirement. And if it doesn't pass, everything is null and void, and we have to go back to litigation.
Let's assume it does pass. It sounds to me like the schools don't get a nickel this academic year.
Yes, they do.
Oh, they do.
The formula will go in place
in May.
In May,
okay.
They'll get all the additional money that they would have gotten had it been in place.
But they
for
don't
the whole
really
year.
Have it to spend this year because they can't count on it coming.
They'll
right?
have it in the last few weeks. But basically, most of that money will be moved into next year.
Right.
So
if a school official and I'm doing rational planning, and I think, if this thing passed, I get a pile of money in May. I can't spend that money this year, right?
Exactly.
Because it would be irresponsible.
But the legislature did put a provision in the law that districts are allowed to carry those monies over to the next year. So districts can start building a plan moving forward because they know how many dollars they'll have coming in this year, plus those dollars will be in the formula again for next year.
All right.
And Chuck, you're going to stick around for this next segment because, of course, we have more questions for you. And Andrew Morrill will pipe in. Let's go ahead and go to break as we talk with Chuck Essex with Government Relations Arizona Association of School Business Officials. And Andrew Morrill with Arizona Education Association. You're listening right now to The Think Tank right here on KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back discussing education finance with Chuck Essig, the major guru in the state of Arizona on school finance, and Andrew Morrill, president of AEA. But first, let us listen to the governor of Arizona and what he said when he signed the education deal that was passed this week.
To our teachers, we know your worth. We have immense respect and regard for the work you do for our kids, our schools, and our communities. With this plan, you will have the resources you've been asking for.
Okay, Andrew Morrill, that is what the governor said. The governor said, in the classroom, you're going to have the resources you need. What's your take? Is that a done deal?
No, not by any means. This is an important settlement. This answers a really important question that voters felt they were answering in the year 2000 when they said we want our districts to be able to keep up with inflation. As Chuck very well explained, there was an interruption in that for a period of time. This case settles that question. We have so many more questions to address. The clarity of this was really established by parents who have said again and again all this time and very loudly in the last year or so, we want our schools funded. We want our teachers paid. Look, this money is going to help, but it's not going to get us back to where we were before Arizona experienced the largest cuts in a five-year period of any state in the country to K-12 education funding.
So would it be fair to say this staves off further cuts, but it doesn't make up for the cuts that have been put in the last 10 years?
Well, there will still be legislators out there that are just convinced we ought to be cutting education funding. I think the appetite for that is going to wane. I think there's a new ethic out there. You have the Senate president, you have the Speaker of the House, you've got the governor, and you've got the education community joining parents saying we needed to do something about education funding. The settlement of this court case answers a very important question about inflation funding. We never intended, we the plaintiffs, never intended for the education funding conversation to stop with this settlement.
So let's talk at the level of the individual classroom now. We have this deal. What are parents and students going to feel as a result of this deal? How much changes?
Well, combined with a really successful set of bonds and overrides that passed at the local level, what you see is very clearly communities and parents wanting their schools funded. I think there's going to be a sense that Arizona might be taking a few steps in the right direction. Districts will be able to use this money for purposes that they identify. One of the things that was very important to the plaintiffs was to keep the strings off this, since it had been cut from general funding. We felt strongly that it needed to go back into districts and that governing boards working with their staffs and their teachers should figure out the priorities. Would that mean salaries and compensation? Very important. We're losing too many great teachers because they can't afford to stay in the profession they love. Would it go to class size management, which is also a big challenge in Arizona? Would we bring back programs that had been cut because districts could no longer afford to offer them? There are a lot of really key priority areas. We probably can't address all of them with this money, but we can make some headway on one or two of them.
And the money we're talking about is, as we said, it's about $270 per student.
It's appreciable.
I hate to talk about millions and billions,
right?
Because people don't understand what that means.
That's right.
But I think I can understand an average of $270 per kid. That's not the be all and the end all, but it's not nothing.
Well, what does that actually cover, Andrew? Because that's what the listeners want to know. They've got their kids in the classroom. They're on the PTOs, and they're struggling just to get an electronic in their classroom that almost every single class has in the California districts. So what kind of steps, or is there any kind of gap that's being covered now that schools with overrides and all of these other dollars that should have been coming from the general fund?
Well, and that's really the case. That's why you see so many parents and local voters supporting bonds and overrides, because they know that with the state cutting funding at that level, they were going to have to supply the answer. Governing boards are the best place. The local school district, that's long been an ethic in Arizona, and that really is the best place to decide where these funds ought to go. Because let's remember, governing boards are elected by the voters and taxpayers in a school district. They are accountable through open meetings to those folks. They will discuss their budgets and their strategic plans. We hope that they do that with their employees in a meaningful process where the best ideas are put on the table. That doesn't happen everywhere in the state, but it happens in a good many places, because then you get the perspective of those in the classroom saying, we've got to address these needs. These are the areas that will most help students move forward in their learning. Some of that will be teacher pay. Some of that will be controlling class size. Some of that might be purchasing materials that the district simply could not afford.
And my takeaway from what you're saying is which one of those it is will vary by district.
And that's exactly right. And really, that's the way voters tend to like it in Arizona.
Well, it's also true of a lot of, having seen a lot of budgetary thing, when you get money without strings, that's much more useful. If money says you have to use it for X, Y, and Z, you look at that, and sometimes you play games. I'll put this in X, Y, Z, but how can I move some money somewhere else to put it where we really need it?
Well, and I really want to
no
hit on that.
No strings money is better money.
That's right. And especially, we have to remember, this is not new money. This is money that was owed. Mm-hmm. This is money that should have been there all along for districts to make these decisions. And no strings doesn't mean no accountability. Mm-hmm. What no strings means is the state's not telling every district across the state what to do. Community members in Kyrene, which might be different than Tempe-L, which might be different than Tucson Unified, which might be different than Tuba City or Flagstaff or Sierra Vista. That's where these questions can be answered. That's where voters who really own the public school system can help provide answers for where that money ought to go.
I wonder if you made general allusion to this, but I'm struck by the fact that there were 28 bond and override elections this last week. Basically 22-4 and 2 undecided. Pretty overwhelming.
I'll tell you what, pretty overwhelming statement of support from community members saying, if the state won't do it, we will. We will see that our schools are funded. And let's remember that there are those out there that want to take that mechanism away from local communities and do away with bonds and overrides. Let's remember now, we've got a pretty clear voter answer that they value those mechanisms to put money in their schools.
Well, and that's a good question for Chuck Essex about that money. We keep hearing, you know, the figure about Arizona is 47th, 48th in the nation. It's, you're comparing apples to oranges. Utah keeps getting rated lower than us, but the story there is that Utah doesn't put into its funding formula or its funding for the students the same things we do. We go and rob the kitchen sink, but we don't. We don't do that in the state
of
Utah.
Quick answer, we're running out of time.
Okay. Well, just to follow, Arizona, we're 48th. There's no doubt about it. We've been 48th for the last few years. We'll stay at 48th. That doesn't mean that we can't solve some problems with the dollars, but we need to have the flexibility, especially, as Andrew pointed out. So one district over the last couple of years may have concentrated on keeping class size at its current level and didn't pay its teachers as much as they should have.
So they could do something else with that money.
And now they have the choice of what they can backfill the holes that were created by the lack of inflation funding.
You guys, we need another half hour to talk about this.
Let's do it right now.
But we have in studio with us Professor Lee Bebout with Arizona State University. He was attacked on Fox News, and we'll have that story for what he's teaching in his class. He has a spring class starting again, so we'll be back in just a moment.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we move from the education budget to the substance of education. We're still in a classroom filled with teachers and ex-teachers. Lee Bebout is a professor at ASU, and he owns the distinction of having recently been attacked on Fox News. Let's listen to a clip.
Well, if you think you've heard it all about what's going on at our nation's universities, think again. A new course offered at Arizona State University is called this, U.S. Race Theory and the Problem of Whiteness. The course is taught by this man, Assistant Professor Lee Bebout, who is white. Right. And here with more is Arizona State University student and correspondent for campusreform.org, Lauren Clark. Good morning to you, Lauren.
Good morning, Elizabeth. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's great to have you here. So let's just run down here. The description of the Problem of Whiteness course, I want to let everybody know. It says this. It's a little wordy here, but it's the post-colonialist, psychoanalytic, deconstructionist, feminist, new historicist. I mean, once you get through that, maybe that would tell you what the class is about.
It's a mouthful for sure.
But you were concerned when you saw the books that were required for this course, correct? What were they?
Correct. So in the books for this course, Critical Race Theory, Everyday Language of Racism, amongst others, all of these books have a disturbing trend, and that's pointing to all white people as the root cause of social injustices for this country. So clearly we see a course that's causing more problems than it does solutions.
Yeah. Okay, that was the clip and the essence of what was said there. Professor Bebout is here. Tell us, what is your class actually about, and was it portrayed fairly?
Well, it was not portrayed fairly. I don't think that you can accurately describe a 16-week investigation of something by reading the subtitle of a course or the titles of the books or a few of the books assigned in the course. The class is actually looking at race in the United States and how whiteness is constructed across time since the 17th century into the contemporary day. Often in the United States, when we talk about race, we talk about people of color. We're talking about Mexican Americans, we're talking about Latinos, we're talking about Asians, we're talking about black folk. But what's often left out is the experiences and the perspectives of white folk and how whites understand race, talk about race, and sometimes actually avoid talking about race or confronting race. And so that's what the course is about.
You often hear that by white. Well, I never think about, I'm white, I never think about race.
Exactly.
It's built into your assumption.
Exactly. One of the central tenets of critical whiteness studies is looking at how whiteness is constructed as a normal or a universal or an ideal perspective. So people don't think about themselves as raced white. They don't think about themselves as having a particular experience, but rather an experience that all other people should share. And then if they don't share, that those other people are somehow not living up to a standard, which is obviously unfair.
Maybe not fully American?
Maybe not fully American, or at least not completely rational, right? And so one of the things about this class is to understand that whiteness is historically constructed, it is situated, and it is not a universal experience.
So, and before bringing you on here, you made an interesting comment that whiteness is different from white race. You want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, a lot of times when people were responding to the class, they thought this was an attack on white people. But whiteness itself is an ideology that has certain beliefs and certain language or rhetorical practices that are embedded in it, such as, oh, I don't see race, or, well, this is just my experience, or, well, I don't mean to be racist, but whiteness is also an ideology that has attached itself to a social location, right? It's attached itself to a social group. And one of the things that's imperative to understand about a class like this is we don't take white people as a racial idea as something that works across time without changing. Whiteness and the idea of the white race has shaped and shifted over the last few hundred years, and it changes depending on different locations that you're at. So for a while, the Irish were not considered white in the United States, and now they're considered white. Ian Haney Lopez has a wonderful book called White by Law, and he tracks different Supreme Court cases and other court cases to look at how whiteness changed depending on legal definitions across the last 150 years.
So what's the next cultural group that's going to enter into that in your studies, into the whiteness arena?
You know, I'm not really sure. Some people would make the arguments that Latinos are the new white, and I think that that is a really problematic argument. Latinos, in my work other than critical whiteness studies, is in Chicano studies or Mexican American studies. Latinos have historically been, or Mexicans have historically been, considered legally white and then socially not white. So they could serve on juries in New Mexico, but not serve on juries in Texas in the early 20th century. Their legal whiteness was a way of keeping them off of juries, but socially they were considered unwhite in that they would attend segregated schools, even here in Arizona, or they were socially unwhite because they would be segregated at restaurants or denied service at restaurants. And some folks have made the argument that Latinos are going to be white, but I think that that is a kind of a problematic argument to make.
Fox News brought this up not recently. We've seen some talk about this. You have a class that's starting back up in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
When Fox came up with this story and came after you, what was your life like?
It was utterly bizarre. As an individual, perhaps I should take a step back. It didn't start with Fox News. It started with Campus Reform. They published, a student and journalist at ASU published a blog entry on Campus Reform. The next day she was on Fox News. You just played a clip of her. And that was uncomfortable and it was stressful. I was also going up for tenure at the time. That's generally stressful. So that was an
added. That's more than stress.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was in the fetal position before this started, right? I was like shaking and crying. But then about a week afterwards is when neo-Nazi groups started protesting on campus, started flyering my neighborhood, and I was worried that I might actually be unsafe. So as an individual who has this happen to him, I was terrified. I was nervous about my job. I was scared for the safety of my family at points. But as a scholar, that was horrifying. And then as a scholar who studies these things and studies whiteness and white supremacy, this was absolutely fascinating because it started with Campus Reform, then it went to Fox, then it went to the National Youth Front, who is now being sued, so they're changing their name, but they're a neo-Nazi organization. But then the next month, the same three, in successive order, also attacked people at Appalachian State University. I think that's in North Carolina. And then also attacked, later in that semester, Seda Grundy for comments on Twitter. She's a professor at Boston University. So as a scholar who is interested in studying languages of white supremacy, I was fascinated how Campus Reform, then Fox News, then neo-Nazis, obviously different groups in some ways, but they're all deploying the same rhetoric. They're saying white people are being attacked. This is the war on Christmas. Now it's the war on whites. And they all built on the same discursive tradition, right? They're all using the same arguments. So as somebody who's in an English department, even though my degree is technically not in English, as somebody who's in an English department who's very concerned with language, very concerned with arguments, that part was fascinating. So as a scholar, fascinating. As a human, it was horrible.
It was terrifying because some of the threats you were getting. Remind us of what was going on in the personal life, if you can go in there without traumatizing yourself.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily sure I would classify them all as threats, although the police certainly did classify some of them. Much of them were hate mail. I think my favorite, and I say this in a half-joking way, was a piece of hate mail in the first couple days that said, you should follow Martin Luther King's dream and you should treat people by the content of their character and you're a race traitor. And I was like, whoa.
Interesting juxtaposition.
Yeah, I was like, do you not notice the dissonance between saying I should be post-racial and I'm a race traitor? That was strange. But then there were other emails that were sent to me that just suggested that I should be hanging by a light pole or that I should die of brain cancer. But in all honesty, that is what it is. It's not what I expected. I'm turning it into something more beneficial. I have a graduate student who actually works on rhetorics of white supremacy. He's studying those. But
he has a great case study to work with.
He has a couple good, really good case studies to work with because this is what he works on. But I'm much more interested in not the attacks that I receive, but the ways in which the class can benefit people and the conversations that can be built out of it.
A fascinating topic. We will take it up when we turn with Professor Lee Bebout. And Andrew Morrill was not only AEA president, but also taught literature. He may have something to say. He's still in the studio when we come back in the Think Tank, KTAR 92.3 News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, Mike O'Neill back here with Holiday Moore in for Mike Russell. And Professor Lee Bebout of ASU teaches a course on, tell us about that. You changed the name of the course, didn't you? I think you took the sort of a little bit of the edge off of a target there.
Took the problem out of it.
Yeah, yeah, well, the original iteration of the title was, I think, U.S. Theory and the Problem of Whiteness.
And there was people fixated on the word problem.
They absolutely did. They conflated whiteness with white people and problem only as a social ill or something that's evil as opposed to something that we need to understand.
And your critic, the student, ended, and we had a quote, we may use it again, but you suggest, and I quote, this is her quote, he suggests that the entire race is a problem.
Yeah, which is, of course, not the purpose of the class or what we're trying to deal with. And so what I ended up doing is I put in U.S. race theory, or no, whiteness and U.S. race theory is kind of a placeholder course title when I was in the middle of last semester, all this was going on. And I thought, hey, I probably need to reevaluate the title, but I'm also going to change the focus of the class a little bit, mm-hmm. not because of the outside controversy, but rather some of the nuts and bolts of the class itself. Mm-hmm. And so I changed the title.
And a good class will always evolve over time.
Absolutely. So I wanted to focus less on critical race theory and more on critical whiteness studies.
Explain now, the difference.
They are overlapping, but critical race studies or critical race theory is looking at the construction of race and racism in the United States, and it's going to deal with folks
who are... The construction of race means what?
Oh, there I go, talking all academic again. Yeah. How race is made, because we're not necessarily born of a specific race. Race isn't a biological concept. It's how we look, but it's also what the meanings that society gives to us because of our looks.
It's about meaning.
It's absolutely about meaning. And we're not born knowing these things, but we learn them over time.
There's a cultural interchange of what's happening that causes and effects.
I have one big picture kind of reaction to this whole thing, and that is that it seems to me that in college, one of the fundamentally important things is to present an opportunity to present students with ideas that they might be uncomfortable with.
Yes, absolutely.
And it seems to me that your class can fill that bill.
Yeah. I mean, that's the idea for me in this class, is not to make a safe space where everybody is comfortable, but we can actually all be a little bit uncomfortable and share in a deeper conversation about race in the United States, right? Because if we're all comfortable, then we're probably going to avoid difficult,
thorny, complex issues. We're going to avoid talking about anything that matters.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Lee, it was brought up in when it happened that ASU was slow to come to your defense, and you kind of were hanging there for a little while wondering who's going to come to my side on this. They weren't necessarily dragging their feet. They were doing due diligence. Is that what I understood?
You know, honestly, you'd probably have to ask people in ASU administration about that. They came out with a statement I think the same day that it came out on Fox. But I think the critique other people have made, not myself, but that other people have made, is that once more extreme elements got involved, there was not a response to that. I think it was a mixed response, I'll be honest there. And I think it's probably fair to leave it at that, because there are a lot of different players and a lot of different issues that ASU administration has to contend with. That being said, while I say it was mixed, I look at other universities' responses to other faculty and how quick they are to hang them out to dry, and I didn't feel that way. I did feel personally supported.
Andrew, you've taught in this area.
Well, I think there's really a vertical connection here. I mean, we're talking about a full professor at ASU who's bringing his students into a domain that really is all around them on a daily basis. To live in America is to encounter all kinds of issues in race. But what I think the critics of this course miss is that somehow he took his students too far. And the suggestion from the student who was speaking on the clip was, well, I just wonder what these students leave this class thinking. You know what I like? They left the class thinking. And we begin that pursuit of intellectual ideas in high schools, and I will tell you that students are ready to take on those issues. I was just to say, I'm not going to tell my students what to think, but I sure am going to give them things to think about. And for 15 and 16 and 17-year-old students in our public school system to understand who's in the American public and how language is actually an instrument of power and captures all kinds of social
absolutely.
And political ideas.
You control the language in any political debate.
Absolutely.
You control the language that describes it, you've already won the argument.
And I used to tell those students in those college prep classes, I want you armed for battle, mm-hmm. but I also want you to leave high school and know how to take apart somebody's argument if it's based on fallacy and stereotype and illogic. You are going to be an American consumer. You're going to be given messages thousands of times a week. When you leave my classroom, you will at least know how to spot the assumptions driving those messages, how to make your way through a world of ideas and exchanges on a daily basis. America is the land of ideas. So on an academic level, or even thinking about the ethical development of students, the more we give them to think about, the more they're thinking. And I like that.
So Lauren Clark was the student that was complaining for her organization. Did she actually attend your class or anyone from the organization that felt offended by it?
No, and I'll ask if you listen to the clip, she says that she tried to contact me, but I never received an email from her, and nor did I get a voicemail because I don't have my voicemail set up at the university.
But so, she was not a student in
no,
your
she
class.
No, she was never a student in class. Can I go back to something that Andrew just said? Is that all right?
Yeah,
absolutely. Because he was talking about the power of language, which is something I really stress as a toolkit for the students in this class. Years ago, when I started delving into critical whiteness studies, I was teaching at another university in East Texas, which, if you're not familiar with East Texas, it is rural and it is fairly conservative. And the student base was often rural, not always, but often pretty conservative, and that's fine. But I would be teaching classes on multi-ethnic literature, right? Asian American lit, Native American lit, Mexican American lit, whatnot. And I would find students who, white students in particular, who would glom on and just embrace the material, and they might be a little bit overly romantic about it. But then I would find other students, and often white students, who would shut down, who would cross their arms, and who wouldn't say anything. And one of the things that's really shaped the way I teach is trying to draw all the students, those who are excited and those who want to shut down, into a conversation. And the way that I do that in the classroom is to stress a common language. Instead of saying, oh, well, this is racist and this is racism and blah, blah, blah.
Which shuts down a conversation.
Which absolutely shuts down a conversation. I try to give them, okay, well, wouldn't you say racism? What do you mean? Do you mean interpersonal bigotry, like somebody says a bad word about you? Or do you mean structural racism? Because those are fundamentally different things. Housing segregation in the United States is different than using a racial slur. And so one of the strategies I use as a teacher actually is, and this probably sounds a little authoritarian, but I half jokingly forbid my students from asking the question, is this racist? Because it's a question that doesn't really get us anywhere. The question that I have them ask is, how does race function in this moment? Because instead of arguing about whether or not Mark Twain's Huck Finn is a racist text, arguments can be made for a yes and for a no on that. We have a much more in-depth conversation about the shift in consciousness of Huck Finn. And at the end of the book, what does it mean that he knew that Jim was white inside, which is a line from it? Does that mean that Huck is no longer racist? No, I don't think so. But it means that Huck's belief that Jim is somehow equal is because Jim is somehow white. And that should shift our conversation about how race works.
I think back to all the times I taught Huck Finn in my American Lit course, Honors American Lit, and that moment that students were always attracted to in the book where Huck has the opportunity to turn Jim in.
Yeah.
Now, every law and every power structure at that point points to doing that as the correct
thing.
That
was the right thing to do in that environment.
You know what then? Forget it. I'd rather go to hell. And in that moment of clarity for him is a kind of growth. If we think that doesn't pertain to how 15, 16, 17, and 18-year-olds are growing up in America with all these different ideas out there on a media that is more active than it's ever been, we're fooling ourselves about how academics really does develop a student's ability to think critically. Again, not telling them what to think, but telling them how to analyze.
It's very easy to look back on a society 100 years ago and say it had all this stuff and all this stuff was wrong.
Right.
But I think the harder part is to move to, all right, now look at our current
society.
Now look
at your own.
What assumptions are built into our existing structures that somebody may look at in 100 years and say, well, that's wrong.
And that's why we need the right education funding in our K-12 system to do exactly
that. Nice way to wrap it up.
100% yes.
That was coming.
Yeah, we saw that one coming. We're going to wrap it up ourselves right now. I want to say thank you to Chuck Essigs for coming on in and Andrew Morrill. Thank you both for coming in to talk about the funding, the funding setup we're about to hit in May.
Thanks for letting us stay.
And Lee Bebout, ASU professor.
Thanks.
Now tenured, I believe, right?
Yes, I'm tenured, and I'm an associate professor, so not been completely promoted yet.
On behalf of Mike O'Neill and myself, and Mike Russell will be back next week, I'm Holiday Moore sitting in for Mike on The Think Tank on KTAR News.